we didn't just want to be this kind of like generalist, here we are, food site with a forum. We yeah. wanted to actually give people meaningful things to do and make sure that anybody's interaction had a way of having an impact on the quality of the content, on the site itself, on the sense of community.
Everyone, welcome back. I'm your host, Anu Dugal, and this is The 2%, a podcast highlighting women who are breaking barriers and building the businesses of the future. In today's episode, I chat with Amanda Hesser, the co-founder and CEO of Food52, the company on a mission to inspire people to eat thoughtfully and live joyfully. We discuss Amanda's background in food journalism, platform's evolution from content to commerce, and more thoughtfully responding to customer feedback. Amanda also shares how she has seen the food industry continue to evolve throughout the pandemic, as well as her thoughts on the future of food, her long-term vision for Food52, and of course, her favorite restaurant in New York. I can't wait to share this conversation with a fellow foodie and alumni of the La Varenne Culinary School. So let's get right to it. Amanda, so great to have you on here today. I think, you know, for me, it's especially exciting given that we have a little bit of shared history in the experience of both attending the La Varenne Cooking School. So super excited to just hear more about your prior history before starting Food52 and how that led you to, you know, starting the company and where you are today. But I think maybe we can just start off with where are we finding you today and how's your day going?
Thank you so much for having me and really pleased to get some time to talk with you. And I'm talking with you from Brooklyn, New York, and I'm in the apartment that I've lived in for almost 20 years.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
Yeah. So all's going well. It's a, you know, it's a classic hot, sticky day in New York City.
So maybe we can start with your background as food editor at the New York Times and then cookbook author. You know, would love to hear, you know, how La Varenne kind of factored into your food experiences and, you know, eventually what that was like and how that led you to Food52.
Great. Yeah. So during college is when I, you know, got really interested in food and started working in restaurants and bakeries. And after college, wanted to figure out like how to continue on this path. And so I ended up moving to Europe and working in four different countries. And I did want to go to cooking school, but I wanted to apply for this kind of work study program at La Varenne, which was in France. And so I kind of did things backwards. I worked in a bunch of restaurants and bakeries and then went to cooking school and worked for Anne as her, essentially her personal assistant for the school and also for her cookbooks. And you know, at that point, I was really hooked on like, you know, staying in the food industry, wasn't totally sure what I wanted to do yet. And when I was there, I started writing. And so I got, you know, my cooking degree, you know, living at her chateau in Burgundy, which was pretty, pretty sweet.
Amazing.
Yeah. And stayed there for a couple of years. And then I did start writing a book, my first book, which was actually about her gardener. What it was like to cook from the garden. Yeah. And so I moved home and really started writing in earnest, and earnest being a key word, being like, I wanted to be a writer. I hadn't had much writing experience, but I just like with a lot of things, I winged it and found that I did have a writing voice that people responded to. And so after that, I continued on that path. I started freelancing and eventually got a call from the New York Times and got the job at, you know, which when I was 24, I was hired as a reporter in the dining section. What was then called the dining section. Now they've yeah. gone back to just calling it, you know, cooking. Yeah. And it was really a dream job and a great way to kind of immerse myself in food journalism.
And what was that experience like?
It was intimidating. You know, I'd never lived in New York City, you know, so I suddenly was like thrust into this kind of big urban environment, finding my way, and having to really figure out, how to do my job and how to find stories. And, you know, I do think I had like a nose for, you know, what would be a good story, but I really had so much to kind of sort through and figure out when I got to the city, because I didn't know anyone. And I actually had one friend who lived in New York, but she worked nights. So, you know, I had to kind of establish a whole new life here. And it was really exciting and daunting. And you know, I think, like, you know, New York always never makes it easy on you, but then you feel like you've earned something if you stay.
Did you have, you know, I'm assuming this was during the period in New York when kind of the celebrity chef and, you know, fine dining and just generally the food world was very much, you know, kind of starting to emerge as a really exciting sphere. Did you have any mentors or people who helped you navigate the city?
Yes, I did. The editor who hired me, Rick Flass, at the Times, was a great mentor, both, you know, in terms of learning more about journalism, but also, you know, just he was great about, like, kind of sending me on assignments that he knew would force me to explore a new neighborhood or a new cuisine or, you know, new way of looking at things. And that was really, really great. And yeah, it wasn't like I had like one specific person. It was really kind of, you know, finding my way, meeting people. And I think, you know, that's a lot of what you do in journalism. You find the best people to ask questions of and learn as much as you can. And so, you know, and it is true. What you were saying is, like, food was really, and the restaurant culture in New York was really exploding at this time. And it was breaking out of the kind of rigid confines of French cuisine, mm-hmm. And these kind of very structured styles of restaurants. Mm-hmm. And then it felt like there was this big boom of restaurants and very focused on Manhattan and actually very focused on kind of more expensive, finer dining. And, you know, that the newspaper really covered that very intensely. And, I most of the stories that I did, I was a feature writer. So I wrote about a lot, like a broad spectrum of things, but I often was writing about, like, what was happening in restaurants. And it's been so hard, I mean, amazing and also heartening to see how the restaurant culture in New York City has evolved since then and continues to. And, you know, there was then this kind of period where all of these young chefs were kind of coming of age and finding that they couldn't afford, you know, to start a restaurant in Manhattan. So they did it in their own neighborhoods in Brooklyn and, you know, in Queens and elsewhere. And just like in the outer boroughs, and which seemed like this kind of crazy idea that you were going to get people to go out there to dine. But what people were forgetting is actually there are people out there who live there who also want to eat well. And, you know, that this was really kind of this kind of food movement was taking over the city, but it was also becoming, I would say, inclusive to a broader, not entirely inclusive, let's be clear, but, like, inclusive to a broader spectrum of people. Yeah. And obviously that has continued to progress, but it was, you know, it's been really, I feel lucky to have, you know, moved to New York when I did and been able to cover the food industry during such, you know, big moments of change. And I think that you know, that evolution will continue on. And especially now, I think post pandemic, where a lot of restaurants either, you know, had to change their business model or they closed, or, you know, chefs themselves are just thinking differently about the work that they do and how they want to spend their time. And, you know, the workforce has shifted a lot. And while it's rocky now, I think eventually, I think it will be really interesting and actually probably really good for our food culture. And hopefully, I think we'll push it to become even more inclusive in lots of different ways. I just think that the pandemic has had such a big impact on the way people see their lives and their careers. And I think also has really, I mean, while I think everyone's very happy to be going out now, but I think people have a different relationship with food now that they, you know, they see how valuable it was in a time of crisis.
Yeah.
And so I really feel like it's, you know, I'm obviously not covering food as a journalist myself anymore, but I think it's a really exciting time to be in this world and having an impact on it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As someone who has always been incredibly hooked and kind of addicted to gourmet, I love what you've built with Food 52 and particularly the e-commerce side of things. I'm definitely also guilty of being, you know, probably spent way too much money on it, but
don't feel guilty about that.
Yeah, no, I just set up, like, my new house and, you know, there's a lot that came from Food 52, but yeah, would love to just hear how did you come up with the idea? And, you know, I know you started out with content and then, you know, have evolved into e-commerce and now private label, which I think is so exciting and needed. So we'd love to just hear about that.
So I started Food 52 with my friend Meryl Stubbs, and she and I ran the company together until just last year. And, you know, I think, you know, she went to Le Cordon Bleu, not La Varenne, but, you know, we had some parallels in our backgrounds, and, you know, she had run a catering company, and, you know, we'd both been immersed in this world. And I think found ourselves, kind of dissatisfied with what was available to us in terms of online media, shopping, you know, getting the tools and the gear, but not just the utilitarian things, but like the, you know, the things that you want in your kitchen, that feel beautiful and meaningful and lasting, and, that make it a happy place for you to spend time.
Yep.
And we also thought that, you know, no one was really taking advantage of technology to bring people together in a way that is so natural for food and cooking. You know, like it's inherently social to, you know, share food, cook together, talk about food,
review, all that.
Yeah. And there wasn't really a place to do that we felt connected to, and or that we felt reflected the energy that was happening offline, which was, you know, there was all this momentous change that I was just, you know, mentioning earlier in the food world, and yet online it felt very dated. And so I think, you know, the company really grew out of a very kind of organic, visceral response to what we were seeing and what we were feeling as consumers. It was definitely not something that we were like, you know, doing an MBA paper on. Like, we were very much looking to solve what we saw like as like flaws in kind of digital media, the consumer experience. If you see food as a center of a well-lived life. Also, we just felt like food was becoming just a bigger part of our culture, and no company was really acknowledging that in a deep, meaningful way. And so I think like we intrinsically understood that like there was an opportunity here. What that was going to look like, I don't think we had like the crispest, you know, idea, but we understood that the most important thing that we could do in the beginning was to create a relationship and a meaningful connection, emotional connection between us and people online. And I think one of the things that, you know, we felt deeply was that it felt online, the internet just felt incredibly impersonal. Mm-hmm. Like even at sites that we love, you just had no idea like who works here. Yeah. Where is their, do they have an office? Where is it? Yeah. Like, are they like, and all these things that you kind of get a sense of either from like print products or from a company, if you were able to visit their store. And we just thought, you know, like we want to solve for that as well as for like flaws in the media, digital media business model. And like, and we wanted to create this hub, this place where you could have a very, you know, like kind of comprehensive, unified social experience, as well as like get the content you need, get the products you want. But the first thing we had to start with was establishing a really strong, like editorial visual voice that connected people to each other. And that made people feel like an emotional pull and a loyalty and a trust that was, we felt like no one was doing really well online. And the most effective way to do that is through content. And I think that's something that we understood from our professional backgrounds of, you know, writing that, you know, the reason people read the New York Times is because it has, you know, and I know that not everyone agrees with this, but obviously many millions of people do. That it's a trustworthy news source, and they build that trust every day through the report that they do every day, and
the quality.
And that's what we needed to establish with, you know, whatever brand we were going to develop, and so that's where we started. A lot of people don't realize this, but we actually had a shop on our site within the first 3 months of our launch.
Oh wow!
We didn't transact with customers. It was really important to us that we put a stake in the ground and said, like this is not going to be just content. There will be products, and there will be other things too. But like, you know, letting people get comfortable with it by us. We had it organized and designed like a shop with different categories and product pages. But if you were on a product page and you liked, you know, the product and you decided to buy, you clicked through, it would take you to the site where you buy it from. And that was, I mean, we didn't do affiliate commission. We didn't do any of the things that, you know, we might do today or that, but, and that was largely because we wanted to build the trust. We didn't want people to think like, we're just trying to like get you to click through so we can get a commission. We wanted you to see, like, we want you to click through because we think this is a really great product and we want you to know about it. And maybe you didn't have time to find it yourself. Like, we're curating that for you.
Or you're looking for it and, you know, you don't know, you know, nobody else is giving you a recommendation that, again, going back to trust, like you feel like you can really kind of depend on.
Yeah. And at that point in, I would say it's not that long ago, it was like 2009, 2010, but how you did commerce online was very different from now. I mean, obviously there was e-commerce, but it was earlier days and there weren't, you know, the established platforms like, as established platforms like Shopify, and they existed, but they weren't as kind of sophisticated as they are now. And we knew, like, we didn't want to do inventory right off the bat. We wanted to do drop ship, but we wanted to be the merchant of record. Like, there were a lot of things that we were trying to like figure out and understand about what kind of business we wanted and what kind of commerce business we wanted to create. And so we didn't launch. We tested commerce in like real, like actually transacting with our customers in 2012, and then launched our shop officially with our own proprietary platform that we built in 2013. And then we have grown the business from there. And, you know, it took off immediately, which was really nice. And I think because, again, sometimes things are just timing, right? You're hitting people at the time that like they're suddenly becoming comfortable with the idea of like shopping from a site where they also get their recipes or they also go to read essays or what have you. And then we've just essentially kind of evolved that, again, like just by listening to our audiences. And I think that's something that we've done from the very beginning, is we really listen to what they're telling us, not just being led by data.
I was just going to ask, when you say listen to your audience, I know some of our other podcast guests have also mentioned that that's like a crucial part of their success. How do you guys interact or find ways to do that efficiently?
So there are a million ways and they're not necessarily efficient. And I don't really care about that. Because if you really want to listen to people, you have to do the work. And sometimes that means responding to their comments on social posts and like getting more information. And sometimes it means doing a survey. And a lot of times it's like people are reaching out and just sometimes they come with a very strong conviction about something they think we're doing wrong or that we should be doing better. Or sometimes they're just reaching out with a question and their question is extremely telling, you know, and I'll give you an example of that. One of the things that we started learning early on with our shop was that we were just getting a lot of questions about, you know, where the products were made, how sustainable were they? And at the same time, we were also seeing that products that were very specifically made in a, you know, either sustainable fashion or sustainable materials were outperforming other products. And so it doesn't take a rocket scientist to put those things together and realize that actually, like, we skew toward an audience that cares about this. This is a value. It's a value of ours. So it's not a surprise, right? It's like something that we were already covering in our content. So we were already probably, you know, connecting with people for whom this is a priority. And so, but then we did the kind of work of listening what kinds of sustainable products matter to them. And, you know, it's something that like factors into how we think of kind of everything we do going forward. You know, another example is, home products. And this one is more just like seeing how people behaved. You know, we were planning to do more home content because one of our convictions is that it seemed crazy to us that the kitchen was always treated as this like other part of your house that was like separate from the rest of your house, when actually that's not at all how people live or think about their kitchen. The kitchen is often the heart of the home. Mm-hmm. It's where people spend the most time. It's the first place people gather when they come over. It's where you read your mail. It's where, you talk to your kids, all of that. And therefore, the design of your kitchen is completely interrelated to with every the design of your bedroom, your laundry room, your bathrooms, what have you. And so it was natural to us that we could, you know, yes, we're named Food 52, but then that we would extend our content would cover all areas of the home because we were focused on the heart of the home. But we hadn't gotten there yet. But our shop team was starting to source home products just out of their own kind of interests and like relationships that they were building. And those products were selling so well. And it told us that, you know, our community trusted us beyond the kitchen.
Yeah.
And that they too saw the connection that we saw. And so that actually drove us to fast track our home content. So, you know, again, you listen to people in a lot of different ways. It's everything from like DMs that you get, I get, or Food 52 gets, or to, you know, your customer care team is ears to the ground. I think people, you know, anybody on our content teams, when they hear from somebody in the comment section of a blog post or they're out at a party, it's just like keeping your ear to the ground and being open and not rigid about what you're doing.
In terms of, no, this is super helpful and so interesting. In terms of community specifically, going back to kind of what you mentioned earlier, how did you think about building community in those early days? You know, I, as a big fan of the food world and the restaurant world, you know, read the dining section, you know, love food magazines, but definitely felt like there wasn't a space to be able to really share that with others. So how did you think about building that on Food 52?
So I think that with community, there are a couple of things that I think we understood in the beginning and a couple of things that we have learned. One is that communities are not like freeform communities are not great. Like they often kind of devolve into either like, you know, negative behavior or like communities. If you think about any kind of community in the physical world, like there's often like there's a set of value, a shared set of values. There's some form of leadership. There's a point of view or direction that is a guiding force. Mm-hmm. So we felt like that was really important. That's why we felt like we didn't just want to be this kind of like generalist, here we are, food site with a, you know, a forum. We wanted to actually give people meaningful things to do and make sure that anybody's interaction had a way of like having an impact on the quality of the content, on the site itself, on the sense of community. And so, you know, in the beginning, what we had recipe contests, and the idea was that, you know, people who were really like ambitious, really great cooks who wanted to show off their work would have this platform, and they could have a much higher lift, you know, in engagement, where they would, you know, have to be adding their recipes to the site. But anybody who like voted on those recipes or wanted to test those recipes or commented on those recipes, that had that carried weight in how that recipe was prioritized on the site and in search. And so the point being that we would say, here's the recipe contest theme. Like we would be the guidance. We would be the presence there. We would provide that leadership, but then let everyone else really like interact in ways, in whatever level of engagement they wanted, but have it be meaningful. And so like we learned, you know, and I think we understood, but we also, it was reinforced that people, they want direction. They want to actually contribute in ways that feel substantive. And of course, they're, you know, your vast majority of your community is going to be people who are readers and observers and just want to be there. And they are getting what they need out of it, but that you need to have ways for people to contribute. We used to call it, we used to say that we didn't have a community, we had a constructive community. And the other thing that I think that was really important to us from the very beginning was that we didn't think of like, we're running this company and then we have a community.
Yeah.
We thought of like, we are all part of the community. And I feel like whether you're an engineer at Food 52 or, you know, an art director or, you know, a founder, like everyone has a place in the community and should be participating. And I think that goes a long way, because we always just felt like a turned off by companies that had like that sort of like the community button over here, you know, the community should be everywhere.
Yeah.
And it means different things to different people. And now, I mean, since we've launched, community has really kind of iterated and proliferated in different ways, you know. Instagram didn't exist when we launched.
Yeah.
We very much have a community on, we have a couple of different communities on Instagram. We have, because we have a couple of different accounts.
Yeah.
And and even within our own main account, there are different kind of groups that follow different things, different pieces, you know, certain kinds of content that we post weekly.
Yeah.
And that's great. Like, I think actually that's the beauty of technology is you're able to create lots of different kind of communities that meet people where they are and ideally provide them with what they're looking for in that moment. And sometimes that's inspiration. Sometimes that's entertainment. Sometimes it's information. And sometimes it's like discovery of products or just meeting other people, right? And chatting and feeling like, okay, there's somebody who hears me or who I can like share this with.
Yeah. I think also, particularly with Food 52, a lot of it is finding people who also share your passion. You know, cooking dishes, great, or buying a new home product, but you know, to find others who are like, oh, I totally understand why you love that broom from that French brand that's like, you know, mint blue. you know, not speaking from experience or anything, but
I know exactly what you're talking about.
So it's, I think, I don't know, the value that you get is finding people who, you know, are just as excited as you are about things that may not be as obvious to most other people. So I think, you know, two other areas that that I know you're thinking of expanding into, which I think are super interesting. So, you know, one is brick and mortar and kind of retail. And then the second is a recent acquisition of Dansk. So we'd love to just hear, you know, how you're thinking about Food 52 5 years from now and what's the big vision?
You know, like our mission hasn't changed. And, you know, it's really to help people, you know, enjoy what we think are life's most important pleasures, you know, which are like food and family and home and, and connection to each other. And so, you know, I think that you probably have kind of picked up on this already is that I think what the most important thing for us to do as a company is to stay nimble and keep our ear to the ground and sort of see what people are understand and listen to what people are looking for. Because we're... Like food isn't going out of fashion, right? It's always been in, but it has kind of changed shape and its sort of significance culturally has shifted. I think it's really important that as a company we're staying responsive to that. And so, a lot of like what we are going to do in the next couple of years is really in reaction to that. And the reason we want to do brick and mortar is because, as I said earlier, it's like food is inherently social. Before the pandemic, we did a lot of events, we did pop-ups, we always knew that, and they were always like, you know, sold out or packed or, you know, they're very kind of, you know, well received. And it also just felt like such a natural way for us to connect with our community. So brick and mortar has always been on our kind of wish list of, you know, things that we want to get to. It feels like the timing is right now. And it also, we never envisioned a store that's really just focused on selling things. We've always envisioned something that felt much more like a community hub and felt very much like our office is very much an inspiration in that it's a very dynamic kind of active place where, you know, when you get off the elevator, there's a kitchen where there's a bunch of cooks, you know, making things, there's photos being taken, there's, you know, products being wheeled around on carts. There's a kind of hive of activity and it changes every day. And I think that we want to create a space that feels that way. And that where you can, content will be created, you know, where you can come and get a cup of coffee. You could watch something, you could participate, you could take a class, you could touch and feel a product that you've seen online, but haven't, you know, but wanted to see in person. You can meet other people, you can get some pantry ingredients for dinner. Like, you know, there's a lot for us to do. And we want to really reimagine what an in-person experience can be. And so we're working on that. And the idea would be to, you know, ideally in 5 years, we have a bunch of them. And I think in terms of, you know, what we're doing as a, you know, digitally, like, again, like, who knows what platform, like TikTok, you know, kind of came out of nowhere. Yeah. And that's now something that's like very much a big part of what we do. And I think, again, like, just continuing to be like, flexible and nimble about like how, you know, how we're reaching people, finding where they are, and continuing to like ideally surprise and delight them with the content that we're doing as well as the products. And, you know, buying Dansk was really a dream. It's like, it's a, you know, this amazing it's actually an American brand, although it was obviously celebrated Danish design, and it was created in the 50s, was, you know, made an incredibly high quality, but accessible products, and with a focus on design and making things in your kitchen and table be, you know, have them be really beautiful. And, you know, not your kind of like starchy old silver and china. And it's a brand that I've loved for, you know, my adult life, and something that lots of people collect. And we felt like it was an opportunity for us to have another kind of brand that we nurtured that was very different from our own, which is called 5-2. And I think that's will definitely be part of our continuing strategy, is to, you know, cover the world of the kitchen and home, you know, sometimes through things that we develop in-house, and like other product lines that we develop in the house, and continuing to celebrate the many, you know, hundreds of makers that around the world that we work with who are producing great things that we want to continue supporting. And then also, you know, ideally acquiring some brands that we feel like we can really get behind and kind of nurture in the way that we do and bring to life through the storytelling that we do.
So, you know, part of the, I guess, the focus of this podcast is addressing this gap, which I'm sure you're aware of, as it relates to funding for companies started by women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think every female founder has a different journey and a different experience. But I'm curious, you know, from your point of view, you know, I think at last count, the amount of funding that went towards companies started by women last year, I believe, was about 2.5 billion out of 100, which is obviously a huge, you know, there's a huge delta there. And so I'm just curious, you know, from your position, what do you think it will take to really see more equity as it relates to this gender gap in funding for companies started by women?
Of course, everyone would love a quick solution. I do think that there is good progress being made. Of course, I would love to see more, but I don't know, maybe I'm a little older, but I, you know, the way I've always thought about it is, and the way I've kind of thought about a lot of things in my life, is just the best way to make progress is to prove it out. Mm-hmm. So I feel really determined as a female founder to have, you know, our company succeed. And to me, that's like the more women whose companies succeed. Yeah. And I think you probably know the stats better than me, but there is a really good success rate among either companies that are founded by women or that have at least one female founder, you know, which is not unlike many diversity statistics, where when you have diversity, there is often aligned with success. You know, I think that the more examples, you know, if you think about like venture capitalists, like they like pattern matching, right? Yeah. And so if you have a greater pattern of women founders succeeding, that will help, I think, gain traction, and it will be a bit of a snowball effect. I know that's probably not a satisfying answer to a lot of people, and I certainly understand it and feel it myself. but I kind of do think that that is probably the most realistic way, and certainly how I've kind of kept myself motivated and focused is like, I really want to, I like kind of proving people wrong and surprising people, and I certainly don't have. Not only am I a woman, but I definitely started my company when I was, you know, I was in my mid-30s, had kids. I come from a writer's background. I am not a like forceful business school personality. So I have all the things, like I don't check any boxes. Mm-hmm. But I've got a lot of grit. And so I think, you know, there's probably going to be a sort of a generation of founders who really did have to like, you know, rely on a lot of kind of grit and resilience, and hopefully that will pave the way for a bit of an easier, well, not easier, but like a more equitable path. For others.
I completely agree. I think there's nothing like proving by example, and I think fortunately, you know, especially I would say in the last like 2 or 3 years, we've seen, you know, like even today, Sarah Friar Nextdoor went public, so you're seeing more and more of this, which I think is really exciting and inspirational. So we're going to now move into our lightning round. And this is basically, you know, questions where, you know, I'll ask you the question, whatever comes to mind first, you know, feel free to answer. And I am going to take a slightly different spin from our normal questions, given, you know, we do have like an incredible food and restaurant expert on the line. So I'm going to start with, what is your current favorite restaurant in Brooklyn or Manhattan?
I'm going to answer that with what was my husband and my favorite restaurant before the pandemic. We haven't had a chance to get back there yet, but it was the place that we always gravitated toward for our date nights. And it's called Roman's, and it's in Brooklyn. Uh-huh. And they change the menu every day. Their cocktail menu is bitter or sweet. You just choose which flavor profile you want. And then like each day they have a different cocktail that kind of fits into either of those flavors. And just, it has such a, it's tiny and even a little crowded, but it's just like, it feels very real and soulful.
Yeah, that's perfect. What is your favorite meal to make for dinner?
I'll tell you, I don't have a favorite meal, but there's a dish that I make in the summer that my kids and everyone loves. And yeah, it's the simplest thing in the world,
yeah,
but you get really great tomatoes and cut them into thick slices and lay them out on plates. And then you take a stick of butter. Well, it depends on how many people you're serving, but generally about a stick of butter, and you brown it. So it gets all like nutty flavored, yeah, and then you spoon it over the tomatoes, mm-hmm, and then just add flaky like mull and sea salt and pepper. Uh-huh. And as it hits the tomatoes, it like sizzles. Uh-huh. And I can't explain why, but when you eat this, it tastes like lobster. There's something about the tomato and brown butter combo, yeah, that reminds you of eating lobster. And it's just really delicious and super simple. And it's like no one can mess it up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to try that tonight. my favorite is actually, you know, from La Varenne. It's the cheese, the tomatoes, the goat cheese and the tomatoes on the toast.
Oh, nice.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then roast chicken and tart tatin. So that's like my, you know, throwback to my cooking days.
I love making tart tatin because, yeah, I love the like risk factor. You don't, yeah, you know, you don't know how it's going to turn out, no matter how many times you've made it. And all you can do is read like the bubbles on the side. And yeah, it's like, are they the right color caramel? Have, yeah, I burned the ones on the base? Like you just, and I do like love that about cooking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that there's certain unknowns and the challenge, and like, and also that you get to know dishes like that over time, even if you can't entirely master it. And that's what I love about cooking is there is no really mastering of cooking,
yeah,
right? You're just constantly learning and like evolving. Like, I think if you had asked me that question 10 years ago, I would have answered it totally differently because I think I was a different cook 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. Where do you find inspiration?
Traveling usually. I find there's two things I do. One is I walk a lot, and I find that when I like perambulating kind of helps the creative side of my brain get going. And I find just being out in the world very inspiring. And even if it's not something related to something that I'm seeing, it helps my brain kind of like process and come up with new ideas. I used to do that when I was at the New York Times. Before I sat down to write a story, I would go walk because I would often get the lead would come to my head while I was walking. But then for inspiration of like new ideas and really like kind of being moved by new things, travel is, I think, yeah, just the greatest thing. And it just kind of like, I feel like it opens up your world and also gets you stuck out of your, you know, the ruts, yeah, that we all get stuck in.
Absolutely. Last question. What is your guilty pleasure?
So I don't feel guilty about pleasure.
Great answer.
That's it.
And where can our listeners find you online?
A couple places. I'm at Amanda Hesser, all one word, on Instagram and Twitter. And at Food 52, I'm always there. I'm Amanda at Food 52. And I do a video every Saturday where I cook in my kitchen, and it often doesn't go as perfectly as I planned. And that's just fine.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, it was such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to the 2% for today's episode featuring Amanda Hesser of Food 52. As soon as we finished recording, I had to try out Amanda's tomato recipe, and I have to say, I was very impressed. I definitely encourage you to give it a try, and I hope you learned as much from this conversation as I did. Stay in touch with us on Instagram at Female Founders Fund and on Twitter at FCubeVC. And for those of you building the next billion-dollar businesses, we'd love to hear from you. Send all pitch decks to pitches@femalefoundersfund.com and we'll be in touch. And finally, if you're interested in working at one of our 45-plus female-founded startups, explore our job opportunities at jobs.femalefoundersfund.com. Make sure to subscribe to the 2% on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you are listening. And stay tuned for our next episode with powerful women founding and funding the future. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes or simply tell a friend about the show. That would help us out too. Until next time, I'm Anu Dugal, and this has been the 2%.